From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, what if the secret to getting along, you know, in politics, race relations, was math? The mathematician Eugenia Chang believes it just might be because, as she points out in a new book, math isn't just about numbers, it's about logic. So she'll join us to explain how logic can give us the template for making good arguments. We'll be right back.
Maybe you've heard we're a divided country, but here at KUER, we're going to challenge that idea. I'm Andrea Smartin, the host of Next Door Strangers, a new podcast about finding connection in a time of division. For this to work, we need your help. We'll be asking you to try some things that might take you out of your comfort zone, but maybe that's what we need right now. Next Door Strangers, a new podcast from KUER. Subscribe at KUER.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Eugenia Chang has written a book to teach you how to have an argument, how to use logic and marshal information to make your case. The truth is, she's not really interested in the conclusion you come to or the thing you argue for or against, as much as she's interested in how you have the argument. Because she's heard a lot of crummy ones lately. In fact, she says these days, this era of blame and shouting, the arguments are usually weak. They rely too much on emotion. They don't often make any logical sense. And logic, she says, is the key. Chang is a mathematician, a scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. And she thinks math could help fix this because math is a discipline that's all about logic. It's not just about numbers and equations. It's about creating a framework for having a discussion, a debate, an argument. People, she says, will always disagree about things, but she believes if we could all agree on what the argument is really about, we can make better decisions. We can find common ground. We can maybe even get along better. Eugenia Chang joined us recently from the studios of Chicago Public Media to talk about her book. It's called The Art of Logic in an Illogical World. So I guess I wanted to start with what it is that got you thinking about the book and applying logic to some of these societal things. I mean, one of the things you mentioned early in the book is just how the world is, as you put it, awash with terrible arguments. And we'll get to that point where you mention toward the end of the book where you say you want more good arguments. But was there a particular moment that got you thinking about all of this? I mean, you mentioned, you know, fake news and terrible arguments and all the kinds of shouting. So was it just the general tenor of the time that got you thinking about wanting to write this?
It was definitely a progression as events in world politics developed in particular directions. And then it was also inspired by my art students at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. And I truly believe that to teach well, it's really important to understand what motivates your students and to tap into that to steer them towards the things that you're trying to get them motivated about. And I realized that my art students are really motivated by questions and issues of social justice. And so I started trying to bring those in to our class discussions as much as possible. And then during the run-up to the 2016 election and after it, I sat down and I thought, what can I, as a pure mathematician, possibly do to contribute to the world in this moment that we're in? And because I believe it's really important to do that, to look at what you can do to contribute. And I know that many people sat around feeling helpless and futile and like everything was completely impossible. And I thought, no, there must be something I can do. And I decided that it was this, because I look at the divisive and very extreme arguments around, and I always find that I can understand why everybody is saying the things that they're saying. And oddly enough, that comes from my brain's discipline as an abstract mathematician. And this might sound very counterintuitive. And thus I thought, well, I better write this into a book so that I can try and explain what I think is going on.
I think it is counterintuitive to a lot of people. And that's one of the myths that you address early on in the book about mathematics. This idea that mathematics is about numbers and equations, or as you say, it's not the only way, you know, that's not the only way to solve problems, is to turn life situations into numbers and solve them that way. So talk a little bit about that myth, what mathematics, you say, is really, because you describe it as the study of how things work.
Right. There is a very widespread myth that math is just about numbers and equations and solving specific problems. And as a result, many people who aren't mathematically inclined feel that they don't need to understand math, and particularly that if a situation doesn't involve numbers, then it's nothing to do with math. So everybody thinks that when you're calculating your tip at a restaurant, then that's math. And everyone thinks when you're doing your taxes, that's math, and adding up your grocery bill. But math is so much more than that. And yes, math did start with the study of numbers. But the wonderful thing, well, one of the wonderful things I particularly love about math is that it goes two ways. You start by studying something, and then you develop rigorous ways of studying it. And then you go back and say, oh, what other things could I also study using these methods? And then you get more things like shapes and patterns. And then you go, what more ways can I use to study those? And it keeps growing like that. Whereas if you study birds, you can't just invent new things and declare them to be birds. Because birds are an actual concrete thing. Whereas in mathematics, anything that you can, if you can find a way to study it logically, if you can find a way to make it into an idea rather than a concrete object, then you can start developing ways to study it logically. And that, I think of that as the double discipline of mathematics. Mm. There's the part where you abstract from the situation to find really its essence. And then there's the part where you use logical methods and very, very complex logical methods that you develop and practice to reason about those abstract concepts.
You write that there's this idea that math is about right or wrong. But what you say is that it's about the sense in which something is right and wrong. And that distinction seems important. Explain that.
That is another myth about math, that it's all about right and wrong answers. And some people really like it in high school because of that. They like its certainty. And other people really hate it because of that. And my art students often tell me that they're not interested in questions that have clear right and wrong answers. They're artists. Mm. And the thing that makes me bemused about both of those positions is that I don't think that math is all about right and wrong at all. And it, as you say, it's about finding the sense in which something can be right and wrong. And what we do in advanced math is we build different abstract worlds in which different things are possible. Sometimes people say to me, well, things in math just are true, right? Mm. 1 add 1 just is 2.
Yeah.
And the thing is that 1 add 1 is only 2 in the ordinary numbers. There are plenty of situations where 1 add 1 isn't 2, in fact. And there are even ones that we can think about in daily life, like when children might say, I'm not hungry, and then have hysterics. And then they go, I'm not, and then you can't tell whether they're hungry or not.
Right.
And so in that case, 1 not, as it were, plus another not is actually like 0 nots. And that's another mathematical world in which slightly different things can be true. And when we're having arguments, bad arguments tend to be about each side trying to show that they're right and the other person is wrong, whereas a better argument says, let us find the sense in which this person is right. Because there is almost always, and I say almost always because I'm very careful about the way I use language, I'd like to say always, but I feel like there's almost always a way that you can see a sense in which somebody has a point.
Yeah.
And that if we find that, then we can start to have a better kind of argument instead of just yelling at each other and making it a fight.
Does it oversimplify it to say that in some ways it's about empathy?
It's very important, I think, to say that it's about empathy. And that's one of the things I stress in the book, that I'm not claiming that logic is the be-all and end-all that should finish off all arguments and decide everything. I talk about how you can have two logical people who are both being logical but come to different conclusions, and that in order to understand what's going on, we have to empathize with them to understand why they are thinking those things. And it usually comes down to different basic starting points for the logic. Mm-hmm. And if we are if we inhabit too strongly our own emotional world, then we can't detach ourselves from it and see that somebody else has a completely different beginning and thus a different conclusion. And so I have found that not only does empathy help us understand other people's logic, but abstraction helps me to empathize with other people because I can break down their argument into small logical steps and temporarily put aside the fact that I might be very upset with the conclusion that they're drawing.
Yeah. I want to get into abstraction here in a moment as we go. I want to say a bit more about emotion, though, because that was something that I think a lot of people will find surprising about the book, just how packed it is with the idea of emotion. Because you say logic gives an argument rigor, but it's emotion that makes the argument convincing. Talk about that interplay and the necessity of emotion, because as I said, I think that will surprise people when we're talking about mathematics, that emotion has a play in logic.
Yes, and it's important that emotion isn't there to back up our arguments.
Yeah.
But when we're teaching mathematics and when we're even explaining research math at a very high level, we don't simply just make logical steps. We say things like, the idea is, and here's how I think of this, and the motivation is, and we draw pictures, and we try and win people over emotionally before we start doing the logical part. At least that's how I do it.
Right.
And if a student gets something wrong or does something that you don't think is valid, it rarely helps simply to show them correct logic. What you really need to do is understand why they thought the thing they were thinking and then nudge them in the direction of thinking that something else is better. If you simply show them the correct logic, then they'll still believe in the thing that they wrote and then there'll just be a clash. And even in life, I've had situations where I've tried to convince myself of something logically and it cannot overcome the strong emotions I'm feeling, especially if those emotions are fear. And my favorite example of this is fear of flying. I used to be profoundly afraid of flying, despite knowing all the statistics about how much safer flying is than driving or walking up the street or, you know, practically sitting at home brushing your teeth. None of those statistics helped to convince me because it was just the thought, the idea of dying in a fiery plane crash that was overwhelmingly terrifying to me. And I think we see all around us at the moment the sense in which emotions are way more powerful than logical arguments. And many logical people and scientific people keep trying to show the evidence for various things, and it doesn't convince people. And if we keep going like that, then the emotions, I say, if we pit logic against emotions in a battle, emotions will always win. So instead of trying to make a battle, we should engage emotions to convince people of the things that we're saying. Otherwise, we're leaving it to people who use less logic to use emotions to convince people of the things that those people want to convince them of, yes, regardless of whether they're logical or not.
Yeah. It's interesting to explore, as you do, why logic is good at accessing the truth and how to make these clear arguments. And this is important. Logic helps us establish, as you put it in the book, these ground rules. It doesn't resolve the issue as much as it gives us, what, the terms for the discussion, right? The ground rules.
Right. It's a framework for how we should come to agreement or not. And this is what all academic disciplines do. They all have a method that they've decided to use to evaluate whether something should count as good information or not. And so in science, there's evidence. And in mathematics, it's rigorous logic. And the discipline of rigorous logic in mathematics teaches us several things that are important for arguments in life. One is that logic has to start from somewhere. Logic involves deducing something from something else. You can't deduce something from nothing. Just like if you have no ingredients in your kitchen, you can't make anything. You have to start by getting some ingredients. And those starting points in mathematical logic are called axioms. And they're not things you ever try to prove. They're your basic building blocks that you take. And then you go, I wonder what world I can make from this. And I think in life, those correspond to each person's basic fundamental beliefs. And so if you start with different fundamental beliefs, you will build a different belief system, even if you are using logic. And so different people with different fundamental beliefs have a different belief system that they've built, even if they're using logic. So another point then is that in mathematics, what we often try to do is reduce the world to the most basic possible axioms, so that we've actually achieved something. Because if you just take everything to be if you take all facts to be, all statements to be an axiom, then you don't achieve anything. Everything is then a logical consequence. So if I take all of my beliefs to be fundamental, then I'm not being illogical, but I'm not being very powerfully logical. And there are people who just believe the things they believe because they believe them. And that's not illogical, but it's not illuminating.
Yeah.
And so I talk a lot about how the point isn't simply to be logical, but to somehow be helpful or illuminating or make progress using the logic. If you are afraid of flying, you could just stay at home the whole time and you could never go anywhere and then you'd be safe, but you wouldn't have actually gone anywhere. And the same is true of if you take all your beliefs as fundamental, then you don't get anywhere, even though you're logically sound.
You mentioned one of the things that's powerful about this idea of abstractions. As you say, many different situations can become the same when you start to strip out the details. Say a little bit more about the idea of abstraction and how we get to the abstract world, because this is really, I think, helpful in the way of talking about logic and making this argument.
Mm-hmm. Well, math starts with abstraction, even at the very beginning when we come up with numbers. And if you've ever tried to help a small child learn how to count, which I've done many times, and I love helping small children with math, you just have to keep counting things in front of their eyes. And you count 1, 2, 3 cookies and 1, 2, 3 Lego people and 1, 2, 3 candies. And you just have to kind of wait until they make the leap to understanding what those three things, 3 of this and 3 of that, what they all have in common, which is the abstract concept of 3. And you sort of can't make them do it. You just have to wait until they make that leap. And every time we make those leaps in math, people fall off or don't make it to the other side of the leap. And a lot of times people say to me, I was fine with math until the numbers became letters.
Right.
And that is another kind of abstraction. And the point of it is to find similarities between different situations. And we quite often do that in normal arguments because we make analogies a lot. We try and analyze someone else's argument by saying, but if you think that, that's like saying something, something, something. Like when somebody said that insisting that Christian bakers must bake cakes for same-sex weddings is just like insisting that Jewish people bake cakes for Nazis. And then there is a sense in which those things are analogous, and there is also a sense in which those things are not analogous. And what we do in math is slightly more precise, because we don't just say that some things are analogous, we actually say what the concept is that is making them analogous.
Yeah.
So with the three things, it's the concept of three. And so that abstract concept, once we've thought of it, is the thing I'm saying exists as soon as we've thought of it. Once we've actually made it precise what the principle is that is making things similar to each other. And so to give an example that's more pertinent to the kinds of discussions that go on in the world at the moment, there's the question of voter suppression and the fact that some people are very worried about voter fraud when people are voting who shouldn't be voting, and other people are more worried about voter suppression when people are prevented from voting even though they should be allowed to vote. And this is at an abstract level the same or analogous to the question of whether you should get cancer screening. Because if you're screened for cancer, there's a chance that you'll be diagnosed with cancer even though you don't have cancer. But if you don't go, then there's a chance that you will have cancer and there will be no diagnosis because you didn't go for screening. And then the question becomes, which of those two things are you more afraid of?
Mm.
And the analogy between those situations is the question of false positives and false negatives. So a false positive is where something happens that shouldn't have happened. And a false negative is where something didn't happen that should have happened.
Mm.
And I personally, by performing those abstractions, have realized that there are many, many situations in which I care much more about the false negatives than the false positives. So voter suppression is one. I'm much more worried about people who aren't allowed to vote when they should be. I'm much more worried about missing a cancer diagnosis. And the same is true of things like social services, where some people say, we're giving money to people who are lazy and don't deserve it. Mm-hmm. Whereas I'm much more worried about neglecting people who really do need help and could do with some help. And another analogous situation is the question of affirmative action.
Yeah.
Should we help minorities who've previously been neglected, or do we risk helping people who don't really deserve it? It's another question where I am more worried about false negatives. And another one is the question of sexual harassment, where some people are very worried about the possibility of false accusations of sexual harassment, bringing people down, especially men, and especially, as it happens, white men. Whereas other people are more worried about the false negatives, that is, the quantity of sexual harassment that goes on without it being stopped and without anyone ever being punished for it. And once you realize that all of those situations are at an abstract level the same thing, it becomes much easier to think about them, because then you only have to think about one concept instead of eight.
Yeah.
And it's really a way of using our poor finite brains in a more efficient way.
So how do you use then logic to reconcile those two conflicting ideas? Is it just a part of a discussion? You're having an argument about voter suppression, let's say, and someone, whereas you might be worried about the people who are not going to be allowed to vote, who are eligible, the other person is worried about the people who are allowed to vote who aren't. And how do you use logic in a conversation to sort of find the groundwork, the common groundwork, to have that proper argument?
I think you're right that it's a starting point, really, and a way of framing the conversation rather than saying we're going to resolve it.
Yeah.
But what I think is important here is that once you've found that it is a situation involving false positives and false negatives, we can consider how we weigh them both up.
Right.
And at that point, we can, I think, find that the people who seem to be on opposite sides of the argument are really on the same argument, just in slightly different areas of a grey area. And I talk a lot about grey areas because I think that many arguments become very black and white. And so it seems like it's a huge leap to try and persuade someone to switch side because it's black and it's white. Mm. But actually, we're all on slightly different shades of grey. Mm. And once we can move to seeing that we're all on a bridge that's connected between shades of grey, then it can be a question of just shifting slightly and discussing where we should draw lines rather than actually trying to flip something over. And so in the case of voter suppression, you can then have a more sensible argument about just how prevalent voter fraud really is and why people think that it is prevalent, even though there doesn't seem to be very much evidence backing that up, as opposed to how prevalent voter suppression is and which one is, for example, a worse violation of human rights or the rights of people in democracy, and together with the knock-on effects of who it is who is likely to have their votes suppressed, what demographic and who that benefits, so that we can then look at the knock-on effects of that and have just a slightly more nuanced conversation than there's tons of voter fraud. No, there's tons of voter suppression. Well, there might be both, but the question is to what extent and how much of a problem is it?
Yeah. It sort of gets us to this problem that you write about, that there's a difference between, as you say, formal logical language and informal real world language, and that this is often the source of a lot of confusion. Talk a little bit about that, because I think that distinction's important too.
Yes, in mathematics, one of the reasons that it can seem very forbidding and difficult to get into is because we use language in very specific ways. We use words that maybe aren't very common in normal life, and sometimes we just straight up make words up because we're trying to be so precise about something. But also, we sometimes use normal words in slightly different ways so that we can achieve the kind of precision that we're looking for. And one of the things we always do is make very clear what our definitions are right from the beginning. And if you get into an argument with a mathematician about something, it can be a bit frustrating because it often just ends up coming down to definitions. But there is a point to that, which is that if we haven't even agreed about our basic definitions, then we have no hope of having a sensible argument.
Right.
And I've seen arguments going on about immigration, for example, where there are people involved in the argument who are starting with the definition that all immigrants are illegal. And if you have people starting with that, then there's no point even trying to discuss the issue until we have tried to convince them that it is possible to be an immigrant legally, as I am, for example.
Yeah. It's interesting. So the importance of stripping out ambiguity, that logical language helps us strip out ambiguity, whereas normal language is about communication. And we've got to find a way to get those two together, I guess.
Yes, we do need a way to do both. And mathematics, in a way, is a discipline that has developed for the purpose of having unambiguous arguments. And it has been very successful about that. Mathematicians tend to come to agreement about what counts as a new development and what doesn't. And one of the reasons is because of this very clear framework. Now, of course, everyone in mathematics has agreed on the framework in the first place. And that can be a bit of a problem in normal life if someone doesn't even believe that logic has a point in the first place. And so we might have to convince them even of that starting point. And then my question is, if you don't believe in logic as a starting point, I'm interested to know what someone's framework is for deciding what counts as true or not. And sometimes it's just that they believe a person. They pick a person who they're going to believe and they believe them. And in that case, it becomes more about, I think, first of all, convincing those people. Mm-hmm. And secondly, what is happening in education and what it is that we're doing with the education system that results in people not believing in logic and not believing in science. And can we do something about that?
Well, what do you think about that? I mean, are we more inclined these days to not refer to logic, to not have these common grounds because we're so tribal, because we have such partisan distinctions that are so illogical, but what do you make of the way we're having these debates these days? Are they significantly different, do you think, from the past?
I am not a historian, admittedly, and so I'm not sure about the history of debates, but I think that the speed at which communication happens on the internet now is surely contributing to something. Yeah. And the things like social media, where you have about 4 seconds in which to make a point. And even just, if I dare say so, the radio, where the kind of sound bites that people are looking for seem to have got shorter and shorter, even in my lifetime. Yeah. And the way that movies cut so fast from scene to scene that you barely have any time to develop anything. I think that attention spans have become like that, where it's more important to have a so-called mic drop, where you make everyone's jaw drop in one line, or a meme so that everyone can go boom. And rather than developing a nuanced argument, and really most of the issues that we're discussing in the world are very complicated and nuanced, and they can't be summed up in a one-line meme. And unfortunately, the one-line memes seem to be just as flawed on all sides of the argument. And I often look at all of them and go, fundamentally, I agree with the point that this person is making, but this meme is really faulty. Yeah. And that if you use a faulty argument to back up something I agree with, I'm not going to agree with the argument, even if I agree with the point. So I think that maybe we are losing the art of having slower arguments. It does take more time. And I hope that everyone will take that time to have better arguments rather than just trying to end things with a witty one-liner.
Mm. I want to come back to that part where we were talking about that it's better to look for the sense in which things are true rather than just deciding if something's true or false. Mm-hmm. And it seems like that you have to apply a kind of, we were talking about empathy, but also a kind of humility there. You mentioned there's a PhD supervisor of yours who would say there is a sense in which, like these preludes, it's like, in my opinion or in my experience, there's something more kind of graceful, more accommodating about the way you're presenting these arguments than just being definitive here. And that seems like this idea of, I don't know, humility is a way to something that I was thinking. Does that make sense?
Yes. And I'm glad you mentioned my PhD supervisor, Martin Hyland, who is a very wise, insightful and measured thinker. And he taught me all sorts of really important things. And that's one of them, where it's a bit of a catchphrase, but it's a really good catchphrase, because once you start by saying there is a sense in which, then it really focuses your attention on what that sense is instead of on whether what you're saying is right or wrong. So there is a point you're trying to make, and then you can focus your attention on where it's true or how it's true or in what context it's true. Because often if somebody makes some kind of sweeping statement, they don't really mean that sweeping statement. And I got called out for this on Twitter goodness me, someone called me out on Twitter. But I got called out on it from saying, in my field, nobody reads research papers in journals anymore because everyone's already read the preprint first. And someone said, really? Nobody? So if we count the downloads, will there be zero? Yeah. And so I had to concede and say, okay, I didn't actually mean nobody. I was making a point in a 5-minute interview somewhere. But the sense in which I meant it was very few people, and certainly fewer people than before. And I think one thing that is important is to allow people that space to qualify what they were saying and not hold them to account for the exact words they said in a moment of an argument that was perhaps moving too quickly.
But if you're just in a situation where you're trying to catch someone,
there's not
much you can do. It's like you can't apply this idea of empathy and logic in a situation where someone doesn't really care about the framework, the groundwork. They just want a gotcha. It seems like that's another one of those difficulties that we have to contend with.
Yes, but even if someone is trying to do a gotcha, we don't have to escalate the situation by trying to a gotcha right back at them.
Yeah.
And I've been guilty of this as much as anybody else in the past, because if I feel under attack, then I do the natural thing, which is to try and defend myself. Mm. And that is what tends to make arguments escalate. Whereas in the best arguments I have, when I really trust someone because they're a close friend and I know that they're generous and that they think well of me, then I don't feel ever under attack. And then we can simply explore each other's positions even if we disagree. And so what I try to do in broader life now, even if it's not a friend I'm talking to, is to try and take a deep breath and remember that even if they're trying to attack me and do a gotcha, I don't have to rise to it, and I can simply try to understand what they're trying to say. And if I take my starting point as that I'm really trying to understand what they're thinking, then sometimes I have a chance of diffusing that competitive zero-sum game type of argument.
I wanted to ask you about an important part of the book. Is it an entire section where you write about how logic breaks down and the parts where it can't really help us very well? You know, it has limits. It's a little bit messy in places, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
And you begin this section by discussing, and here's how you put it, the extent to which even mathematical proof is in fact a social construct. And so logical justifications in life are doomed to be as well. Maybe that sounds too complex for some people just starting off, but just sort of explain this part if you would, because I thought this was really interesting.
Well, mathematicians like to portray math as being very rigorous and completely unambiguous, and I've probably said that a few times in this interview already. And so I feel it's important to admit that there is something that is a social construct, which is it's a bit like trial by jury, where you write a proof and you think it's rigorous, but then you offer it to the community and you see if they agree that it's rigorous. Because actually, we don't ever write something to be completely rigorous, because if we did, it would take books and books and books and books and books to get it right back down to the axioms. And so what we really do is we try to convince other people that a logical proof is possible. And so at that point, it becomes about convincing the other people. Now, the thing is that there is also a framework for them refuting it. So they can't just say, well, I don't agree. Well, they can, but then they wouldn't count as a good mathematician. What they need to do is point out a place where they think the logic is flawed. And then you're allowed to respond to that and improve your logic. And often at that point, I have agreed with them and gone, yes, that's true. There is a possible hole there. It doesn't mean that my conclusion is wrong. It just means that there was something that I needed to clarify about my argument in this point. And that back and forth is really important. It's not like you just take a vote and then you either get ting, yes, or and off you go. And I would really like to see that in arguments in life as well, that you construct an argument, and if somebody is confused about some step of it, then they can point out the part and then you can elaborate on that part until the person is convinced. And they might never be actually convinced, for example, if their fundamental starting points are different. But at least if we can find exactly the place where we disagree, if we can find the root of the disagreement, then we've had a much better argument than most of the arguments that happen at the moment.
Yeah. I love that idea of getting people together to sort of work through these things and trying to find the flaws with respect. I mean, you describe it in the book, and it seems like this is a really important theme. You say that this is not a competition. It's a collaborative art.
Right. There are many places where we make competitions that don't really need to be competitions. And when we're all trying to understand the world around us, I would prefer us all to collaborate because I think that we can get further. And especially in normal arguments, there's no need to try and be a winner and make losers. Whereas if we all work together to develop arguments and find more insight into the world, then I think that we can really make progress. Kind of like if we all push in the same direction instead of all opposing each other all the time, pushing in opposite directions, then we're not really getting anywhere. And I don't know if everyone is really trying to get somewhere when they're having an argument, which can be a failing point of the entire thing. If they really do just want to feel like they're cleverer than you, well, if you can even find that out about them, then you've understood something about the situation. If it's all coming down to that, then there might not even be any point engaging, because maybe it's something deeper to do with, maybe they feel unfulfilled in the aspirations that they had when they were younger and that they haven't been able to achieve that. A lot of people feel that the promise of the American dream has not been fulfilled for them. They worked really hard, but they don't have as good a job as they want. And maybe those underlying feelings of disappointment are at the root of why they're really trying to attack people around them all the time.
Eugenia Chang. She's a mathematician, a scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. She joined us from the studios of Chicago Public Media. Her book is called The Art of Logic in an Illogical World. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
If you're about to part ways with your old car, consider donating it to KUER. We'll take your vehicle in almost any condition, and we'll even arrange to pick it up. The proceeds from your donation support the KUER programs you love, like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Radio West. Learn more about our vehicle donation program at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the mathematician Eugenia Chang. We're talking about her book, The Art of Logic in an Illogical World. One of the things you write about is how there are situations, as we mentioned, where logic can't help us. And one of those ways you talk about how it's when logic runs out of fuel. The fuel is information. So what happens when we run out of that fuel, when we run out of the information, barring enough information and you can't use logic? You write about taking that final leap through intuition and gut feeling. And I wanted you to talk about this part of the process.
Yes, too often logic and emotions are put into a dichotomy against each other, as if to be logical, you can't use emotions. And if you're using your emotions, then you're not being logical. And alas, it's often men who have this argument against women, saying, oh, well, you're just being emotional. You're not very logical, are you? And I know that I am both. I am very logical because I am a successful research mathematician, and I'm also extremely emotional. And the two work together because, as you say, sometimes you use logic and you use logic up to a point and then you don't have any more information. So to pick a slightly trivial example, but maybe because it's lunchtime, if you're choosing food from a restaurant menu, then there's a certain amount of logic you can use, because if you simply don't like a food, then you probably shouldn't pick that food. But then at a certain point, you don't actually know what the things are going to taste like. You just have to guess a bit, or you have to go by your, as it were, gut feeling or your intuition. And the same is true when you're doing things like, especially if you're a female person, walking home in the dark at night. If you look down a street and you might just have some kind of vague feeling that something doesn't feel right in that street, then you could use logic and go, well, I can't actually identify what it is, so I'll just go down there anyway. But many of us have learned simply to follow our gut instinct because we can't necessarily explain it. But if we feel that there is something bad going dangerous about that street, then we probably shouldn't walk down there. At least that's what I do. And it's not exactly logical, but it's not illogical either. And so when you run out of information, there's a kind of space of possibilities that you can pick that don't contradict the information. What's actually illogical is if you go ahead and contradict the information at that point. But there is then, if you don't contradict the information, there's still choices that you can make. And those choices will often involve emotion or intuition or that thing where you're at a restaurant and you just wait till everyone's ordered and then you just suddenly pick something at the last minute of whatever suddenly takes your fancy.
Where does trust fit in all of this? Because you say that sometimes trust comes into play when we can't use logic. And you write about that thought experiment of the prisoner's dilemma that helps us kind of explore logic and trust. Would say something
yes.
about that.
The prisoner's dilemma is a very famous and productive thought experiment that philosophers, logicians, and mathematicians study. And the scenario, it's one of those contrived scenarios that yet has something illuminating to tell us, which is that you have two prisoners and the people who are prosecuting them are trying to play them off each other. So they say, if you denounce the other person, you'll get off much more lightly. Whereas if the other person denounces you, then you'll get a much worse sentence. If you both denounce each other, then it's kind of in the middle. Whereas if nobody says anything, then we can't do much about it. I might not have set that up quite right off the top of my head. But the idea is that the logical thing to do is to protect yourself by denouncing the other person.
Yeah.
Because if they denounce you and you don't denounce them, then you're going away for a really long time. So if you denounce them, then you're at least protected against that. And the thing is that as a result, the logical thing, if they're acting as individuals, is to both denounce each other. And so say maybe if they both denounce each other, they'll get 5 years each. But if nobody denounces anyone, there's not a lot that the prosecution can do. So everyone will just kind of get 1 year and then be done with it. And so actually, if they acted as a group, if they were allowed to talk to each other, then probably they would agree not to denounce each other so that they could both get off with 1 year. But if they're not allowed to talk to each other, then it comes down to how much they trust each other to do what's best for the group. And you can probably imagine that maybe a couple who've been together for a really long time would know each other and trust each other well enough not to denounce each other. But random strangers, you'd be more skeptical and that you'd denounce them in order to protect yourself. And so that's why it comes down to trust, that if you have sufficient trust as a group, then you can sometimes override the bad effects of people acting as individuals, even if the individuals are acting logically. And the moral I take from it is kind of that the logic of individuals can be different from the logic of a group if the group can act coherently and collaboratively. And I think that's a really important message. And it's led me to realize that many political disagreements come from a fundamental disagreement about whether you think that people should act as individuals and look after themselves, or whether they should act according to the group and contributing to a group and looking after the group. And I have learned from the prisoner's dilemma that it can be really beneficial to everybody to act as a group rather than an individual. But many people disagree with that.
Yeah. That seems like a fundamental impasse between like political ideologies. Don't you think?
I'm loath to think of anything as a fundamental impasse because I like to think that we should again say what is the sense in
right.
which people think. And there are probably we can probably find situations where even those people who seem to disagree with us, there are some situations where they believe in the group. For example, perhaps they believe in having a national military, for example, that collectively protects us rather than everybody standing around with a gun and protecting themselves. Of course, there are some people who just want to have a cabin in the woods and with their own firearms and completely protect themselves. And maybe those people are quite far away. But I think that with many people, they're not actually as far away as we think, because maybe they believe in roads and some aspects of infrastructure. And if we can find the places where we do agree that some kind of community effort is beneficial, then we can find out where the differences are rather than just going, no, it's an impasse.
Well, it seems like it gets us back to you were talking about axioms before. And this is something you say, you know, before you you know, you have to decide to start with some truths before you can apply logic. And this is where we get to axioms, that we don't try to prove axioms necessarily. We just accept them as some basic truths. And you even write about your own personal axioms, which fall into, as you put it in the book, these three categories. There's kindness, there's knowledge, and there's existence. Talk a little bit more about these axioms, because you also explore in this section of the book where these axioms come from and how we, I guess, how we apply axioms to the way we're thinking about these arguments.
Yes, I have thought a lot about this because I'm trying to be as logical as I can, but also because I know that logic has to start from something, and that if I can find some really fundamental principles, then I don't have to try to explain everything separately if they all boil down to those things. Yeah. And so I think many people have a fundamental principle of kindness, but sometimes that working in one's own best interests can override that. And I think even there is a balance, because at some points in my life, I have wanted so much to prioritize kindness to other people that I haven't always been kind to myself, and that is a problem that some people get into. So I think we can see that there is even a balance there when it comes to kindness to different people. And I've explored how much people care about different people around the world as a basic axiom, because some people get really upset if you don't care enough about a tragedy that happened really far around the world with some people that you don't know in a place you've never been to and where you don't know anybody. Mm-hmm. Whereas if something really bad happens on my own street, then I think it's kind of valid for me to care more about that. And so that is an axiom about kindness that I have explored and look at where it comes from, because I'm always curious to understand why people think the things they do. And sometimes it comes from our education. And because I am in education, I think about this a lot and think about how I think education could be more helpful and more productive. And I think education is sometimes very powerful. And that's why people don't necessarily have the same basic axioms as their parents, for example, maybe because life experience or education came in between. I have many fundamental values from my parents, but some of them are a little bit different. So it can come from your parents. It can come from your education. It can come from something like religion. But then there's a question of where your belief in religion even comes from in the first place.
Right.
And maybe that comes from your parents, or maybe it comes from having some traumatic life event. And if it does come from having some traumatic life event, and that is something that really helped, then that's quite a tricky situation, because I might disagree with some of those fundamental principles, but I might also want to acknowledge that that has helped you get through some kind of trauma in your life, and who am I to disagree with that? And so there's nuance there as well. I think that if some people aren't able to unpack their axioms back very far, we can still try and do it for them, even if they don't have that logical power to do it for themselves. So, for example, sometimes people say that they don't believe in same-sex marriage because they think that marriage should be between a man and a woman. And I think that consists of just saying the same thing twice, because that's the definition of being against same-sex marriage, is believing that marriage should be between a man and a woman. And if you say the same thing twice, then you're not being illogical, but you haven't actually got any more fundamental towards your axioms. And if one of your fundamental axioms simply is that you think marriage should be between a man and a woman, and you really can't explain it any further, then it might be difficult to have a productive discussion. And then I will come instead to wondering why you can't unpack that any further.
Yeah.
And I've often been frustrated when people do things like they split up with their partner and go, oh, I don't really know why, but it just didn't feel right. And I always feel like that's a bit pathetic, that you should be able to come up with a better explanation than that for things. And I think that education, and in particular a mathematical education, helps us to unpack why things are true to more fundamental levels than we might otherwise be able to.
Do you feel, Dr., finally, optimistic about all of this right now, that people are at a point where they're ready to concede certain points and have real conversations as opposed to shouting at each other all of the time? Do you feel like we're at that point, willing to apply some of these principles that you mentioned?
I do fluctuate because, like everybody else, I sit at home and I read the news and I read comments and I get depressed about how futile things seem to be. And sometimes people say to me, oh, you're just being naive. We can't change people's minds. It's hopeless.
Yeah.
And what I think is that if we decide it's hopeless, then it will be hopeless. It will be a completely self-fulfilling prophecy. And I think that sometimes people decide it's futile as a in a way to give up having to take any responsibility for doing anything about it. And in fact, I am generally an optimist because I think that you have to be an optimist to be in education, or that if you go into education, it shows that you have an optimism about the future and about young people. And one thing that really impresses me is young people and children and how they can see through these divisive arguments and often see really sensible things, even though it's coming from the mouth of an 8-year-old or something. And so that is one of the things that gives me optimism about the future. And the other is just talking to individuals and finding that it is possible to have more sensible arguments. There are people who are so far away from us in their points of view that maybe that is a bit futile for now. But if we keep focusing on the most difficult situation, then everything will seem difficult. Whereas if we start by talking to people who are a bit closer to us but not quite there, there are many people I know who want to use better logic but who just aren't equipped to do so, which is one of the reasons I wrote this book. And then we can also reach the people who are being logical but just have different fundamental starting points, and we can have sensible discussions with them. And if we just shift everyone slightly further over to the productive, logical side of things, then I do optimistically think that we can just shift the logical center of gravity of things so that we can move away from being awash and drowning in divisive arguments and have better arguments, slower arguments, and achieve more unity in the world.
It's Dr. Eugenia Chang. She's a mathematician and a scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. She joined us from the studios of Chicago Public Media. Her book is The Art of Logic in an Illogical World. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.